Welcome, everyone, wherever you are in the world, to the Goldster podcast, where we take you behind the scenes with guests of all shades and styles and their fascinating and enriching stories about their lives, their victories, their failures, their ambitions, and, of course, their books. I'm Humphrey Hawksley, your host for the duration. And today we're talking about crime fiction, hard-boiled, cozy, thriller, detective, what makes a bestseller. Please enjoy. To find out more, check us out on www.goldster.co.uk. And without further ado, I'm going to count to five and we begin. Hello and welcome to everyone, wherever you are, to our final Goldster Inside Story of 2022. I hope you had as good a Christmas as can be and all the best for the new year. And welcome to those who will be listening later on our Goldster podcast. To find them, just Google Goldster podcast and it'll come up and you can get in there. What a bumper ride we are in for over the next hour, because my guest is not only a fantastic writer who can draw you into characters and scenes in moments, he's also spread the wings of his trade as far as they can be stretched, and he keeps flying. We are going to delve into areas where Goldster has not yet ventured and save your blushes. First, as he waits amicably next to me, my guest is the chair of the Crime Writers Association, which looks after and mentors authors and oversees the famous Dagger Awards. And please check out the Crime Readers Association, for those of you interested, for all you want to know about crime. Second, he used to run a crime bookshop called Murder One. Third, he was a top-flight London publisher, handling people like William Golding, Peter Ustinov, and Sophie Grigson. Fourth, I'm out of breath already, he ran crime, film, and literary festivals. Fifth, he is a massively best-selling writer, and not just under his own name, and we're going to be discussing Sherlock Holmes. Here is one of the latest and more. This is The Return of Sherlock Holmes, an anthology, and sixth, he worked on film editing and, among others, films Sex in the City, if any of us remember that. And seventh, now fasten your seatbelts, he is a specialist in literary fiction erotica. Remember 50 Shades of Grey? Imagine that with flowing prose and an expansive imagination. It sounds as if he's living the dream. So on that frisky thought, welcome Maxine Jakubowski to Goldster Inside Story.
Thank you for having me.
It's brilliant. Love the bookcase behind you, Maxime. Is that all your volumes or many others?
No, not one book of mine is in the shelves behind me. That's just one of probably three or 400 shelves throughout the house, I'm afraid. I live in a house with about 30,000 books.
30,000 books in your house, goodness.
I haven't counted them, but it's the approximate count friends or experts have told me.
Oh, my God. Goodness gracious.
I have 11 rooms.
Now, at the risk of being socially unacceptable, considering what happened at Buckingham Palace the other day, you have an intriguing surname, Jakubowski. Where do your ancestors come from?
Well, it's quite topical insofar as my mother was born in London, but her parents emigrated to the UK prior to the Russian October Revolution, and they came from Odessa, of course, which is in Ukraine, if disputed right now. And my father was actually Polish, left Poland in 1936 to fight in the international brigades in the Spanish Civil War, and having been wounded in the field, was then repatriated by the winners, by the fascists, with American and Canadian prisoners of war, who were mostly left-wing intellectuals who'd gone to fight in Spain, and arrived in Southampton almost by mistake, and agreed on his return to the UK that he could be sent back to Poland. And then, of course, Hitler invaded Poland, so he never went back. And then met my mother, who was obviously a left-wing intellectual who was friendly with Eric Blair, George Orwell, and many other people who were sympathetic to the Republican cause in Spain. And they married, and here I am.
Goodness gracious. So you are familiar with what we call the ebbs and flows of European friction?
Very much so.
Yeah. And Odessa, of course, is a sort of huge cultural capital, isn't it? I mean, it sprouts many people like yourself.
Well, I've always wanted to go, and I was going to go. And then, of course, COVID happened. And then post-COVID, of course, the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So I fear I will not see Odessa. But to make it even more international, when I was 3 years old, my parents moved to Paris in France, where my mother worked as the Paris correspondent of the British newspaper. And my father set up business. So I was actually brought up in France from the age of three. And I've never been to school in the UK, except for 1 year at the French Lycée in London. So I was brought up in France, actually.
So what's your mother tongue?
Well, it is English. I mean, we spoke English at home because it's the only language that my father and my mother had in common. We didn't.
So you've sort of, but when you were growing up in France, that we now know, did you always want to do what you're doing now? And I can't just say you're a writer because you're everything in that world. Or did you ever sort of climb a tree and think you wanted to be an astronaut or a train driver?
Well, at an early stage, I wanted to be a coureur cycliste. I wanted to be on my bicycle and compete in the Tour de France. And then I realized, obviously, I didn't have a physical prowess. But in parallel, obviously, I was an avid reader, devouring a book a day from the age of 10, probably. And I started writing thanks to a very helpful teacher, I think when I was 12, who encouraged me to be more imaginative in my essays. And that was basically all I needed. And I started writing with 13 or 14, and not boasting, because I would never allow the book ever to be republished now. I had the fortune or the misfortune to be published for the first. My first book was published when I was 16 and a half, which is absolutely awful. And it was written in French. To put things into perspective, it then took me another 14 years to get published again.
But on the, I mean, you know, you've given us this fascinating texture of where you come from and everything. But was it nurture or nature? Because your mother was a correspondent, you said, for a British newspaper. Your father knew George Orwell and people like that. So what is it? Is it genetic or is it the environment you grew up in? Or both?
Well, if it was genetic, it's basically on my mother's side. My father read one book in his whole life. My father was a man of action and then a businessman, initially very left-wing and ended up very right-wing and very capitalist.
Oh, I see. How interesting. Yeah, I want to go through all of those 7 points I had, so we might dance around them. And anybody's got any question to ask Maxime, just put it in the chat, put your comments in. We're going to go through a whole raft of things, from crime to erotica to running literary festivals. But I want to talk about your bookshop first, because you ran a crime bookshop for 20 years. Did it make you a lot of money? Was it a lot of work? How does one run a bookshop?
When I basically opened the bookshop after I had left full-time publishing and was somewhat at odds as to how to fill my days, because I can only write 3 or 4 hours a day. And then I'd come across, obviously, a number of specialist bookshops, particularly in North America, where at the time there were, I think, a couple of dozen crime and mystery bookstores. There were also science fiction and fantasy bookstores, and of course the famous Forbidden Planet in London. I sort of thought, why hasn't anybody tried to do a mystery bookshop in the UK? Sherlock Holmes, John Buchan, P.D. James, John le Carré, Old English, but
no. Agatha Christie, yeah.
And Agatha Christie, of course. And I thought, well, why not? Everybody said it'll never work. I had no idea how to run a bookshop. I'd spent my whole career basically in publishing as an editor, so I didn't know the other side of the fence. So I basically did it, with common sense, and it worked.
And did you do it? I mean, was it a full-time job, or were you also writing and doing all your other things at the same time and had other people in to run it?
Initially, I thought I'd spend a couple of days a week at the shop. For the first 10 years, it was more like 3 days and fairly long days. Then in the last 10 years, I was spending less time at the shop and spending more time on my writing, although I also, as people keep on reminding me, used to do a fair bit of writing at the shop, at the back of the shop at my desk. People would see me typing away, and they still remind me of that.
When did you begin, and when did you end with the bookshop?
I think I began, I think it was in the early 1990s, and it lasted 21 years.
1990, so what, until about 2010?
Exactly.
So tell us, how you chose your books, how people bought books, and what you ordered and what they wrote. Give us a nutshell of how that changed in that time.
Well, basically, I mean, the idea behind a specialist bookshop is to make everything available to the reader, the fan. For instance, you mentioned Agatha Christie. How many bookshops can stock all 87 Agatha Christie titles? We did. We had all Agatha Christie, we had all John le Carré, Len Deighton, P.D. James. The whole idea is, if a book was in print in the English language, we would stock it, and we would keep on stocking it. Because that's all we did. All we did was crime and mystery. And if a book wasn't available from British publishers, then I would import American editions of books which were not available in the UK. And that basically was the magic formula, that people could find anything they wanted, including things that were not available, even if they'd ordered them from other bookshops. And
you said 87 titles of Agatha Christie. Did you, over that 20 years, did you sell them all, one of each?
I think we sold hundreds of each over the years.
none lingered on the shelf.
No. We opened the shop. I think we had to start restocking within days. At our height, we had, even though we were a single bookshop, we had a turnover of £1,200,000, and this was 20 years ago. And I had, at the height of Murder One, we had 10 or 11 employees.
Yes. And is there a young, now famous, best-selling crime author that couldn't get put or couldn't get traction in the major book chains that you managed to put out there and percolate into our lives?
Many of them, because obviously the whole principle was, if it's in print, you stock it, whether the author was known or not well known. So, right. I mean, I am told, without being falsely modest, that we did obviously originate the careers of many, many younger British crime writers who began as customers, then became writers, and the writers were always very, very grateful that we hosted, obviously, signings for their first books. And later, when they became famous, we hosted signings when they were famous, when they had a choice of going to Hatchards or something like that. I mean, we had John Grisham did his first ever British signing at Murder One. I mean, we had absolutely everybody. Oh, and some authors, like Colin Dexter, Ruth Rendell, would come in once a year to sign their new books. He was always the first stage on their signing itinerary of the UK. They were very, very helpful.
Did you sell it or did you close it?
No, I closed it. The last 5 years, we could see our profits declining, although we were still profitable as a result of a congestion charge in central London, because we were what is technically termed a destination store, where very few people would come in and buy one paperback. They would buy 6 to 10, if not more. Yeah. In fact, our all-time record, we had a customer who came all the way from Japan, actually went to our Sherlock Holmes section and bought £1,500, and this was 25 years ago, bought £1,500 worth of Sherlock-related books. So we had really big customers. And one could see the profitability diminishing after the congestion charge. And of course, Amazon came on the scene, where basically by pushing a button, you could buy anything, even American imports, and at a huge discount. Yeah. So I could see the writing on the wall. It had been going 21 years, and I thought our lease was also coming up for renewal, so our lease would have, the cost would have gone up. So I decided I'll go back to writing full time. I've done my 20 years. All the staff got double redundancy. All the publishers were paid, and we left with no debts and still some money in the bank. So I mean, it was time. 21 years is a good stint.
I mean, you've given us an idea of the crime writing and reading community now, and now you are the chair of the Crime Writers Association, and which has the Crime Readers Association attached to us. Tell us all what that is.
Well, the Crime Writers Association was started by a British crime writer, an incredibly prolific crime writer called John Creasy, who would write about 6 books a year in his heyday, and ended up, I think, writing over 300 or 350, much more than Simenon, actually, under a variety of pen names. And he got together with other crime writers of his generation, including Agatha Christie, Julian Simmons and others, and they thought it would be nice to have an organisation which all crime writers, crime and thriller writers, could join as both a social club and something to promote the genre. And we're about to turn the pages into 2023, and in 2023, the Crime Writers Association will be celebrating its jubilee, its 70th year in place. It's our platinum jubilee next year.
And for the, you know, you talked about helping the, or stocking the books of the unknown crime writers and helping them up. How does the Crime Writers Association help new authors? And how do the Crime Readers Association, how does that fit into the whole thing?
Well, the Crime Writers Association basically it's not a trade unit. It's an association of writers who stay. We have regional chapters, we organize events, and it's a way of creating a sense of belonging, a sense of community for writers, because basically most writers just sit at home in isolation typing away. So in one way, we give people a sense of community, but also we help. People basically contribute because everybody is a volunteer, nobody is paid. Everybody contributes on a voluntary basis. In basically promoting books, giving tips on research, or having discussions, but also very much social occasions. And of course, we have the Daggers, which are.
I was going to say the very famous Dagger Awards, aren't they? Which
indeed.
Is the Ian Fleming Dagger and things like that. Yes.
These have been going for nearly 55 years now, and we've got a great track record at recognizing talent early on and recognizing, obviously, the biggest writers in the genre. Yeah. And then the Crime Readers Association is an extension, basically, where we open up, obviously, a free email newsletter every month to anybody who wants to join. It's completely free. And I think we have 12,500 people in the Crime Readers Association. And every month, anybody in the CWA can write about the new books they publish. So they also hints, tips, recommendations. And that's basically in parallel with the Crime Writers Association, which is only open to actual writers.
And anybody can join the Crime Readers Association and get all the news of what's happening in cozy crime, thriller crime, all the rest of it.
They go to the CWA website and they'll find how to join. It doesn't cost anything, and you'll get a monthly newsletter and other things from time to time. And everybody who loves crime, mystery and thrillers is absolutely welcome.
Oh, great. So for all our audience, and I know many of you, and we've discussed the cozy crime, the bloody crime, the international crime, because it is the genre, the most famous genre. Check out the Crime Readers Association and join up if you feel like it. You wrote, and also part of the CWA is the Red Herrings, which you do a column in, I think. Here we go. That's your lovely face there, a column. And you wrote a very interesting, put a question in, which was fascinated me about how books seemed to be getting bigger, and there was a Guardian reviewer who sustained an injury when she fell asleep reading the latest Robert Galbraith, that's J.K. Rowling's detective, because what, the book must have fallen on her or something. But your question was actually a good one, is that are editors less ruthless with the pencil and letting things go through? When you were a publisher, how ruthless were you with the editor's pencil?
I personally wasn't very ruthless. Maybe I should have been more. But of course, you have to remember that when I worked in publishing, I was also writing on the side. So I was very much sympathetic to the writer. I knew how much work was actually involved. I mean, one of the funniest things that ever happened to me, I'd just moved companies and I'd joined a new, an existing company when the previous editorial director had left. And on my first day with the new company, I asked my senior editor, so can I see the our backlog, I mean, the list of books which are under contract and when they're going to be delivered, so I can see what's coming in over the next few months. And one of the first books to be delivered was a new book by William Golding. And William Golding had just been awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature just months before. But prior to that, my predecessor in the job had commissioned Bill Golding to write a travelogue about, on Egypt, where he'd gone as a child, and had come with his excellent idea of sending him in there, all expenses paid, to travel down the Nile and write a travel book about it. This was in the heyday of travel writing. And Golding loved the idea. And I saw on my schedule that one of my first books to be delivered during my term, there was one by William Golding, Nobel Prize for Literature. And I was sitting there quaking, thinking, Nobel Prize for Literature is going to come into my office and say, Mr. Jakubowski, here's my book. What am I going to say to him? Mr. Golding did come in basically with a Tesco bag, which was probably about 10 years old, with a manuscript, basically the most filthiest manuscript I've ever seen. He never even used margins. As an old school teacher, he wouldn't waste any part of the thing. We had to then photocopy the manuscript onto larger size paper so that the editors could actually wield the blue pencil. And William Golding came in and so modestly said, Mr. Jakubowski, the contract said I had to write 85,000 words. I'm afraid I've written 105,000 words, but don't tell me, you have my blessing. Cut 20,000, cut anything you want, or you don't need to tell me. And this was the Nobel Prize for Literature. Needless to say, I've worked with other fairly well-known writers since. None of them were that easy.
And did you cut his 20,000 words and he didn't?
I didn't do it personally because I passed it on to one of my senior editors. I had a team, I had an editorial team. And I think she cut about 8,000 words.
But I think William Golding had a huge amount of problems getting Lord of the Flies published. Were you commissioning books and choosing them and rejecting them and that? Is that your job?
Throughout my career as a publisher, yes.
And
that goes with the job.
What is it like? I have to ask this, you know, that you could be the guy that rejects the Beatles, or you could be the guy that rejects John Grisham.
Well, I know of two or three books that I actually did reject that went on to become bestsellers for other publishers, including, and here I'm not seeking any excuses, I'm not a pet or animal lover, and I do not like cats. I'm sorry, it's personal. And in all my publishing jobs, all my editors or the people I worked with knew that I would never commission a cat book, even though cat books always sell. And then one day towards the end of my publishing career, one of my senior editors came up and said, we've got this great cat book with a well-known actress. And I just gave up in despair and said, I'll do it. And it sold 600,000 copies. But I mean, I don't know how I got to this anecdote, but what your question was now.
it was rejecting, Richard, that choice that you make, because I don't think I'd have the courage to do it. You see something and it's beautifully written or whatever, not right for the list, and you say no to it. And then the next moment it's hitting the bestsellers lists all over the world.
Well, I mean, it's the famous William Goldman thing about films, that you never know anything. I mean, who knew that J.K. Rowling's books would become so popular? Who knew that 50 Shades of Grey would become so popular?
Yes.
There was nothing 100% original about them. With all due respect to Jo Rowling, Ursula Le Guin had these sort of boarding school and wizards before, there had been erotic books before. Sometimes it just takes something. It's in the air. And a book
and very small advance with J.K. Rowling. It wasn't a sort of multi-million dollar advance, was it? It was a couple of £1,000 or something.
Yeah, but I've always been convinced when I was working in publishing, even when I was turning books down, even sometimes, I knew that the book was publishable, but maybe it didn't fit in our list or we wouldn't know how to market it. That was the other thing. But I'll always remind people of the fact that if a book is really good, it might be turned down 5, 10, 15 times. If it is really good, eventually it will find the right editor and publisher and it'll get published. And this is what happened with Day of the Jackal, the Jo Rowling books, and so many others. I mean, quality will out.
Yeah. Now, that's a very good piece of advice. If anybody's got any questions to ask about publishing, crime writing, erotica, and Sherlock Holmes that we're going to get onto now, because this is the one that's on my desk at the moment, which is an anthology of Sherlock Holmes. But you talk about quality will out, and that Sherlock Holmes is an enduring character, such that millions around the world think he actually existed and go to Baker Street to look at his house. But what is it? And you're obviously totally intrigued because you've done anthologies and written about him. First question, is Sherlock Holmes cozy crime?
Yes, it is. Absolutely. It is. Yeah. Purely because, obviously, there is no emphasis on the murder. Obviously, if it's poisoned, the people are quickly disposed of. Conan Doyle doesn't linger on the murder. He's more interested in the intellectual puzzle. And that, for me, is what is the essence of the cozy.
Right. And what is it in his character that makes him so enduring?
Because he's unforgettable. Doyle gave so many, uncovered so many aspects to Sherlock Holmes's character that, all those small things of the violin, the cocaine, the little grey cells. It was an unforgettable character, and that's why he's survived so long, influenced so many others, and even after the end of the Sherlock Holmes novels and stories, and once, obviously, the character fell to a certain extent in the public domain, there has been a tsunami of people wanting to continue writing with this character, including some of the cases that Dr. Watson refers to in the Doyle canon, but which Doyle never wrote about. The giant rat of Sumatra is referred to in one of the stories, but he never wrote it. As a result of which, in the last 30 or 40 years, there have been about 10 novels by other hands about Sherlock Holmes and the giant rat of Sumatra, for instance.
You've given an idea of his character and the complexities of it with the cocaine and the intellectual relationship with Dr. Watson. But when you're looking at something like that, where does the plot fit into that? I mean, because you have to balance these, don't you? And he obviously did it in a way that, as you said, it made something in the air.
Well, it's that perfect balance between characters and plot. I mean, the characters, whether Sherlock Holmes, Watson, Moriarty, his brother, Mrs. Hudson, Irene Adler, all the characters are wonderful. And then the plots are like miniature pieces of clockwork, and they just function so perfectly.
Okay, to keep propelling our interest towards the characters as opposed to, as you said, towards the crime or the solution of the crime. Sherlock Holmes against Poirot or Marple in the in the great British readership imagination? How does that balance up?
Well, they're all wonderful characters. I think the difference between them is that even though Sherlock Holmes is Victorian in terms of the times in which he functions, he investigates, Poirot and Miss Marple are more 1930s to 1950s British and therefore have dated slightly. If you reread Conan Doyle now, they're still absolutely wonderful. If you reread Agatha Christie, unfortunately, I mean, they're still wonderful accomplishments, but there is that sense that they are of their time because of the attitudes involved.
That's interesting.
And of course, the Christie estate is obviously keeping them up to date because they're now commissioning Sophie Hannah to write new stories. They've just done a new anthology of new Marple stories written by 12 different women writers from all over the world, which have come up with some very interesting variations. So they're trying to keep it alive, and the same with, for instance, the Ian Fleming estate, who now authorise new James Bond adventures. But of course, this is also helped in parallel by the fact that these incredible characters are now so familiar to readers and viewers because of films and TV.
Yes, that's right. They all, and tell us, this is the one. Is this the latest one?
That is the latest. It's the third of the anthologies I've done around Holmes. I initially did, I think 15 years ago, I did a collection of stories because I thought he'd been murderously neglected. Poor old Professor Moriarty, who actually only appears in three Sherlock Holmes stories, but he's become so famous, and I thought, I want to see more. So I convinced one of my publishers to commission the book, and I then commissioned 30 different writers from all over the world to write a new Professor Moriarty story, and that did well, which then obviously then a publisher in America said, well, would you like to do something similar with Sherlock Holmes? And that did well enough that they said, well, can you now do a second volume, which is the one you have in your hand? But I think it's probably the last Holmes or Holmes-related books I might be involved in for quite some time.
And tell us something about this. Tell us the nub of the most fascinating story in there.
The answer is no. The problem is, I mean, that book was done about 5-6 years ago. And I've done so many other, and I do a lot of anthologies, apart from my own writing. I do a lot of anthologies because obviously, as an ex-publisher, it allows me to still commission writers and encourage people to do writing. And I've done over 125 anthologies in the last 30 years.
What?
Yeah, I'm afraid so, for my sins.
Well, in which case, since you can't tell us the nub of that Sherlock Holmes, we're going to move on to one of your other anthologies, which you alluded to earlier on. And you write erotica anthologies, and before people blush and turn away and say, I just wonder something you put in the introduction of the, I think it's called the Mammoth Book of the Best New Erotica, which I've got. It says it's been my contention that erotic writing should answer to the same standards as any popular form of writing. Think crime and thrillers, science fiction, fantasy, and romance. Not only entertain the reader, but also make him or her think, speculate, or at any rate, leave a mark on their memory and stimulate the imagination. Mere titillation is never enough. Expand on that, Maxime.
Oh, I thought that was the final last word.
No, that was your introduction.
Indeed. Well, I mean, I've always been a great fan of what I would term popular fiction, i.e. genre fiction. And I've always been of the belief that the fact that you're writing crime or erotica or science fiction, fantasy, horror, doesn't mean that you have to lower your standards. You can still write basically with style. You can have depth in the characters in addition to the thematic variation that you're offering. And that's something I've been sticking to all my life. And that's why 90% of my own writing falls into genre fiction.
And the genre fiction of erotica, which if anybody's got any questions for Maxime, I can see, I've just looked at our chat boxes. I know we're between Christmas and New Year, but usually you fill us with questions and comments. Rise up from your hangovers and your celebrations and put in a question, because we're talking about erotica now. And there's all sorts of things to question about that. But we've also talked about Sherlock Holmes running bookshops and publishing. I was started to read the great mammoth book of erotica, and you take us immediately into a character who's come back from Vietnam and is on a sort of hippie beach in sort of community in California, and then all sorts of things happen after he goes into a diner. How do you construct your erotica story? Because in a crime story, you're building up towards a crime, or a thriller towards a disaster. Do you then build up towards the frisky bits?
No, not at all. That particular story, as I said, it's an anthology, so that particular one was by someone else. When I write my own stories, basically, first of all, I need a story, and then I need the characters. The so-called frisky bits basically should just occur naturally as part of a story, either to advance the story or to give depth to the characters. My latest book, which came out just a couple of months ago, is a collection of my own short stories, all written over the last 5 or 6 years, called Death Has a Thousand Faces. And they're noir, they're supernatural, some of them are even science fictional, but the erotic element in all of them, although it's not a book of erotic stories per se, but there is an erotic element throughout. All the stories came that way, obviously. Yes, as a writer, I do have certain obsessions, and I keep on going back to certain themes, certain types of relationships. For my sins in my writing career, I started writing in the science fiction fantasy genre when I was still a teenager. And even then, and slightly later, publishers seeing my manuscripts would always complain, oh, there's a little bit of sex here, there's a little bit of sex there. You don't need it, take it out. I would leave it in, and they would still publish. But I did get that reputation. And the same occurred when I was writing crime. When you have a story, you need characters. You need characters of flesh and blood. You don't need cardboard cutouts. And therefore, when you get real people, when you try and make your characters real, inevitably, in so many of the cases, the question of relationships and sex will intervene. So rather than push it under the duvet, basically, I just bring it out into the open and try and make it natural.
Christine has come in. Thank you, Christine. Is it true that 50 Shades of Grey began as a blog? Or as a blog? You sort of bounced off that huge tsunami that came with 50 Shades of Grey. Did it start as a blog, and then tell us what happened?
No, basically 50 Shades of Grey began as fan fiction, as a slightly more friskier version of the Twilight books. And then graduated into, as I said, into fan fiction, which was published online, and then got so many people interested that mainstream publishers got interested, and the manuscript came out and obviously was revised and eventually was published. But what happened is, as I mentioned, over 30 years or so, publishers were always complaining, oh, Maxim, can you cut out the sex, just leave the crime, or can you cut out the sex, just leave the fantasy? And then 6 months before 50 Shades came out, my literary agent had a few phone calls from publishers saying, oh, something has come up. Wouldn't Maxim be interested in cutting out the crime and cutting out the fantasy and just doing the sex? And they wanted, obviously, books to compete with 50 Shades. And at first I was hesitant, but then my agent said, no, do an outline at least. That started a tsunami whereby, under another name, I wrote 10 books which competed with 50 Shades and sold many millions of copies. We were number two to 50 Shades over a two-year period. And I wrote 10 novels of 400 pages each over 2 years. And they were translated into 31 countries. And the amusing thing is that after the first one appeared, the first reviews on Amazon were by fans of 50 Shades who were looking for more and who said, oh, no, this is disgusting. And then within a week, we moved from 0 stars to 5 stars in our reviews because people said, oh, this is actually quite well written and the characters are quite believable, actually. So we were, because I wrote these with a friend. It was a collaboration with a friend, with a female friend. And the other amusing anecdote about that is that in the UK, more than 50% of the sales were through the supermarkets, through Sainsbury's, Tesco, Asda. And we were still writing the first volume. And of course, the salespeople had already gone out, the cover was already done of the initial volume. And but they said, no, it must be, it must have a woman's name as an author. So I now have a female pseudonym, in fact, who outsells my crime and fantasy by 100-1.
are you still writing it and still?
No. Basically, the vogue for erotica in the wake of 50 Shades lasted a couple of years, and then I think people just got fed up of it. And right now, if my agent or myself were to go, even with my track record, were to go to a publisher saying, oh, my next book is going to be another erotic book, they say, no, we don't want it, we don't want it.
So there's two thoughts come from this. Firstly, it was about 10 years ago, wasn't it, when 50 Shades came out. Did that go through that series of rejections that we were talking about with other authors and then suddenly burst through? But when it did, it burst through. And I remember being at Heathrow catching a flight at WH Smith, and there was a queue of people, mostly women, and all of them were holding 50 Shades of Grey. And I've never, if you see one holding a John Grisham or a Dan Brown Da Vinci Code, that was big. But this was a massive sale, wasn't it?
I know. I mean, basically, because it started with self-publishing and publishing on the internet, and then became so popular that it came to the attention of mainstream publishers who then could put all their marketing sort of know-how behind it. And I mean, I think the books are terrible. I mean, I will send a samizdat photocopy of the initial manuscript, so I knew what it was about when they wanted me to do something to compete with it. And I mean, after one chapter, I threw it against the wall and I never read it again because I thought it was an insult to erotica, but there was an audience for it. I mean, some people were calling it mummy porn.
The publisher in you must have recognized what it was. You know, you might have put your pencil through it a bit more than the publisher, but you must have recognized the market opportunity there, obviously.
Probably, if I had still been in publishing then, I would have turned it down.
We've nailed that one, haven't we, Maxime? Yeah. The man who would have turned down 50. And you mentioned a couple of years. It's quite interesting because you've been in the book trade and the publishing trade. These genres come and go.
It's all publishing goes that way. I mean, in crime, for instance, for many years it was cozies, then psychological dramas, Patricia Highsmith, Ruth Rendell. Then you had female private eyes. With the success of Gone Girl, domestic thrillers became the whole rage. And of course, and I say that as an ex-publisher, publishers are lemmings. If it works for somebody else, not so much yourself, but the marketing people behind you who hold the purse strings will say, no, we want something to compete with Gone Girl, or we want this, we want that. So the editors are not in total control. But if something does well, then obviously the whole market wants to do more of the same. And then suddenly something peters out and then something else comes back into fashion, like Cozy Crime. And I'll say that for Richard Osman.
You said in your Crime Writers column here, the Crime Writers Association column, that Cozy Crime has had a rejuvenation.
Absolutely. Totally out of the blue. Although I think it started with TV, with Robert Thorogood's Death in Paradise. A nice, amiable crime, get everybody basically around the table at the end and reveal who is the culprit, have lots of red herrings. The crimes are not too bloody. The psychology is not too dark. And following on Death on Paradise, obviously, Richard Osman wrote his first retirement
retirement home,
cozy crime book, and it's become a huge success. And I'll say that for Richard. I mean, he is, I met him, we spent time together at festivals. I mean, he knows his crime, he is a fan, he's been reading it for 20 years. And sure, he was a big TV personality, therefore that helped the marketing, but that wouldn't have been enough for them to sell in that quantity. They are good, wonderful entertainment. Yeah. And now, of course, everybody is imitating him.
So we mentioned Cozy Crime, but all these different. So throughout your career, you have adapted your writing to what you think the market is, or what your agent rings up and says, "Actually, Maxine, can we have a bit more sex?" So you just say, "Yep, okay, we can do that." No, say, "Yeah, okay, we can do that." That's your sort of attitude. You're not ideological about what you write.
Oh no, not at all. In fact, the only time I've given in to my agents. Prayers on bended knees was to write, obviously, that erotic series, which, I mean, has done very well, and I can't complain, but most of the time I'm a contrarian. I'll just keep on writing what I want to write.
And when you, I mean, you know, the 50 Shades, which is the erotica or whatever we call that, and then Gone Girl, we mentioned the Da Vinci Code, which was the church and religion and that John Grisham law. And they sort of break through for a bit. And again, what does that say about our societies at the time? So when 50 Shades broke through, was its time right? And so did it say something about what we were thinking about sex and erotica at the time?
I'm not sure. I think basically 50 Shades and 50 Shades phenomenon came at just the right time, somehow brought a lot of new readers. People, I think many of the people and the women and the middle-aged women who were reading 50 Shades were people who actually weren't reading books before and suddenly found that it was something they could enjoy reading. I mean, it was like the... there, but for fortune, go I syndrome. Obviously, it was called mommy porn. Maybe it was the sex they were not getting at home, and it sounded all so dangerous, but it was so much safer to read about it on the page rather than ask their husbands to get, whips or sort of corsets or handcuffs. You read about it and you get your kicks out of it to a certain extent, and it's harmless. And I think it just came. Maybe if it had come maybe 1 year later, it wouldn't have worked. It's just a zeitgeist.
Yes, and it's neutral, as you say, isn't it? You know, it's somebody else has written about it, but you can sort of read it, absorb it, and discuss it. Sue Downey says she bought her husband a book called 50 Sheds of Grey. quite saucy, but fun. Tell us a little more about that, Sue. Did that sell as much as Maxime's books? Can you tell us the name that you wrote under, or is that a secret?
Well, it was a secret at the time, although everybody publishing knew it. They came out as Vina, that's V-I-N-A, Jackson.
Vina Jackson. Vina Jackson.
And the first one was called 80 Colours. Was it 80 Colours Yellow? I can't even remember my own titles now. But
oh, I remember that. I remember that. So they were playing with the title as well.
We had to have a number and we had to have a colour.
Yeah.
And then we ran out. We ran out of the number and the colour. So I think by volume 9, I was allowed to have a real title. And it was my favourite of the series. It's called Mistress of Night and Dawn, which is my favourite in the series.
Yes. It must be quite fun writing erotica.
No, it's hard work.
Why?
10 books, 400 pages each. That's 4,000 pages of variations.
Yes.
You have to be imaginative or mad. And you have to keep it interesting. I'll say one thing, obviously. I wrote those 10 books over a two-year period. I then couldn't write any more fiction for 3 years after that until I came back to fiction. And even then, the only two novels I've written since my 10-book series, which have been more crime and fantasy, have the sex is much more moderate, if I can put it that way, because I'm exhausted.
So in order to you mentioned also that you're suffering from imposter syndrome a bit. I think that's what it's called, because you haven't written a mystery thriller for a decade, yet you are chair of the Crime Writers Association. So you're heading off on a cruise.
On January 5th, I leave for a cruise which will last 42 days. And because I said it's 3.5 years since I wrote my last novel. I mean, it came out obviously a year and a half ago. It may take time to see, get into print. And my last novel was a fantasy, in fact, about the Pied Piper of Hamelin. And the book prior to that was a sort of crime with an apocalyptic background. And I felt it was time to come back to crime. So the book I'm hoping to write the first draft of on this cruise is going to be a thriller. It's about a hit woman. I've written about her before. She's been the minor character in one of my earlier novels. And she also features in about 4 short stories. So I'm now going to give her own book. Right. And you mentioned the imposter syndrome. No, it's just a coincidence that, I mean, I've been on the committee of Crime Art Association for many years, and in a way it was Buggins' turn, which means nobody else volunteered to become chair, because we only stay for 1 or 2 years. Yeah. I'm coming up to the end of my 2 years. But obviously, during that period, I've still been reviewing crime on a monthly basis. I've still been editing collections and obviously still very active, but not actually writing crime. So the novel I hope to write on this particular cruise is going to be a thriller, yes.
And you say thriller, and people interchange crime and thriller and everything. Is it crime? Is it cozy crime? Is it a thriller? Is it hard action? And what's the difference?
Well, a thriller is basically something which also has a sense of adventure. It's not just a murder and an investigation or a puzzle. Spy thrillers, obviously, which, I mean, your books, I would term, are thrillers.
Thrillers, yes.
So, I mean, this particular book, it will not be cozy in any way. Even my other books in other genres are very dark. They're fairly obsessive. They're very noir. And that's basically what I write. So I would be incapable, even if I was offered many, many pounds in advances, I would be totally incapable of writing a cozy. Although I enjoy cozies, and within the crime genre, some of the books I enjoy most are locked-in mysteries and impossible crimes, which are the epitome of cozies.
I think so. Someone once explained to me that a crime book is when there has been a murder or a disaster and you have to find out who did it, whereas a thriller is when there is going to be a disaster and you have to stop it happening. Would you agree with that?
Or you can add also, I mean, I totally agree with the crime definition. Basically, it's a crime is by definition a whodunit. And a thriller can also be a whydunit, where you know from the outset basically who was the killer, but basically why did they do it?
Yes, why did they do it? And how were they allowed, and how didn't they stop them, or whatever it is, that sort of thing. Maxime, stay with us for a moment, because I have to tell our audience what is coming up, and then I've got a couple of other points to pick you up on. Tomorrow, our book of the month, where is it? Truman Capote's Breakfast at Tiffany's. This is a classic with a legendary movie starring Audrey Hepburn and George Peppard, and it's a thin read, so you can even read it between today and tomorrow if you haven't watched it yet, and watch the movie. The reason that we're doing this is because one of our members wanted to know how to teach their 16-year-old granddaughter to read, not teach, coax their granddaughter to read. And we decided that if you can have an accessible book attached to a film, you've got something to talk about. And we decided to go for Breakfast at Tiffany's. And then on January the 3rd, I'm with the newsman and journalist Malcolm Brabant on Purpose, Passion and Grit, our sister show. In 2011, Malcolm went for a routine yellow fever jab. after which he got a very high fever and then descended into months of hallucinatory madness, thinking that he was the second Messiah, which amazingly he and his wife filmed. And it is how he did that and then resumed his career as a foreign correspondent. A fascinating story. I just spoke to him before Maxime and I got together. January the 5th, Michael Coveney, let me get this huge and wonderful book, is a theatre critic, columnist and biographer of the greats like Andrew Lloyd Webber and Maggie Smith. And his latest is this one, Master of the House, The Theatres of Cameron Mackintosh. So come with us into theatre land. And it's a beautiful book. And because it is quite pricey, we're going to hold some sort of competition during the show. And the one that wins it, I'll get Michael to sign it and we will get it to you. So that's our Goals to New Year competition. And then on Friday the 6th, I'm with Mark Everglade. Have I got his book? No, I haven't got his book. Mark Everglade is a young science fiction writer who specializes in a genre called cyberpunk. Don't say girls, it doesn't take you into the unknown. Erotica and cyberpunk. Cyber is the future and punk is where the hero can be, well, sort of punkish, whatever that is. And that one is going to be really, really fun. You do science fiction. What is cyberpunk, Maxime?
Well, it's basically a way of exploring new tech, of blending. Obviously, all the new technologies of the last few decades have showered on us together with a hardball noir ethos, artificial intelligences, people who are more than human. In a way, it's a modern version of science fiction, away from just planet exploration or time travel. A lot of current science fiction can be termed as cyberpunk. Although you also have what they call dieselpunk, which is the same version, but where basically it takes place in a sort of a subverted version of Victorian times. But I'm sure,
oh my goodness.
I'm sure your next guest will explain it much better than I can.
Tell me, because you've got such a broad writing career, of all the genres that we've discussed, because you do science fiction yourself, don't you?
I haven't for some time. I've been more on the supernatural and fantasy side, although my penultimate novel, The Louisiana Republic, takes place in an America after the internet has been wiped out and the continent turns to savagery. California and Louisiana secede, but the book itself is about a private eye who in this new society has to find a missing woman. So it's both science fiction and crime.
And would you call that dystopian?
Yeah, absolutely. Or at least that's what Lee Child, who was kind enough to give me a lovely quote for the cover, said.
and he's semi-retired in Wyoming now, isn't he?
Retired. I keep on sending Lee emails because obviously I'm still doing anthologies and he's done a lot of stories for my anthologies. And I'm happy to boast that he wrote his first ever short story for one of my anthologies in the 1980s, an anthology called First Blood, for all new British writers of that year. I still keep on sending Lee the occasional email and he says, no, I'm retired. I'm not writing another word.
But he's just done a huge masterclass for the BBC on how to write a thriller. So I think that's retired from. But the last question I want to ask you is that all the genres that we've covered, from dystopian to erotica to crime to thriller and everything, which one do you think has the most impact, reflection, whatever you want to say, on the human condition? Which one gets to the heart of things?
God, that's a difficult question. And my off-the-cuff answer is all of them, insofar as if they're done right, they can. They can address basically the contradictions in human society, in human nature. They all do it with basically different clothes on, so to speak.
Different clothes. So erotica can be just as powerful as cozy crime when you're looking at a society.
Cozy crime, I don't think, in fact, maybe I'm being unfair here, but I think cozy crime, in fact, probably has less impact.
Less?
Cozy crime is, by definition, pure entertainment.
less impact than Iraq. I mean, it's absolutely fascinating because and the one other thing is that we talk about literary, don't we? When you know literary fiction and that sort of thing. Conan Doyle, if I'm mistaken, which I might be, was frustrated that he wasn't seen as a literary figure. Absolutely. John le Carré also had the same thing. But what is this literary thing? Is it sort of nonsense?
I don't think so, but obviously it would be remiss for me to comment too much on this because I've been looking, in fact, at the reviews of this collection of mine, which just came out, and all the reviews stress how literary it is. So I'm a lost cause, I'm afraid.
Right, I think I am too. I think talking about our colleague Lee Child, who said, well, you know, the literary fiction they can sit on the shelves for some time, and I'll sell 100 for every one of them. So I'm the guy that keeps them in business. Would you say that about yourself, Maxime?
Well, my erotica has kept me in business financially, but I enjoy most writing, basically. The writing, the books that don't sell in those sort of quantities. I mean, that's where my love resides, so to speak.
Lovely. So any young people listening to this who thinking of becoming an author professionally should head for erotica, should they, if they want to make some money?
Well, maybe if a trend is cyclical, maybe in 10 years. So they've got time to rehearse.
That's right, in 10 years.
As erotica goes, people are always asking, where do you do research? Have they got 10 years to do their research?
10 years to your research, Frederick. What a great note to end on. That's it. The 2022 closes in. Time's Winged Chariot has harvested through, and it's time to bid goodbye to my fantastic guests. Thank you all for listening, and to all of those joining us on the streaming platforms and tuning into our Goals to Podcasts. So Google Goal to Podcasts, and you'll find us. Until tomorrow with Breakfast at Tiffany's, stay involved, stay curious, stay active. I'm tempted to say stay erotic, but I mean, we'll cancel that one out. Stay safe, and of course, stay Goalster. A very happy new year to everybody. Enjoy the season and the festivities. Thank you so much, Maxime Jakubowski, for being such an incredibly interesting and intriguing guest. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening, and find out our vast range on www.goalster.co.uk. Our vision is to help people stay stimulated, active, socializing, and empowered in what we say live happier and healthier for longer. The podcast is one of many strands, which includes nutrition, yoga, art, singing, languages, brain power, love, and many, many others, more than 300, all from the comfort of your home. If you like what you hear, please press that big subscribe button and tell your friends, family, colleagues, community, and yes, your enemies too, about what Goalster does. Spread the word about our incredible range of guests and subject, and until next time, goodbye from all of us at Goalster.